Hello and welcome back. This is Lecture 6 of the American Prison State. I'm Dan D'Amico, and this is Mises Academy. Today's lecture builds upon several of the previous week's lectures. In short, what we have tried to survey is both current and previous sociological perspectives of crime and punishment, current and previous economic perspectives of crime and punishment, as well as the methodological trends within those histories of thought in response to those narratives. I tried to lay out that there is great opportunity for applied political economy from the Austrian and public choice perspectives, or what we could call perhaps radical free market alternatives, especially to these forms of institutions. In general, given that these perspectives, Austrian and public choice, are less investigated and less used and less recognized in this topic of crime and punishment, the debates between sociological perspectives and economic perspectives are at sort of an impasse where sociological perspectives are first and foremost concerned and admit and recognize the largesse and excessiveness that our current system is characterized by. Most of the attention is paid to responding to and understanding what causes mass incarceration and what's been termed punitive severity, especially in America today. Economists, on the other hand, especially neoclassical perspectives, informed most by the work of Gary Becker, in today's discourse, are more attuned to interpret a sort of Coasean status for our current system, where what we have might be considered efficient in comparison to the forms of institutional transaction costs that would be associated with institutional changes. So in other words, if implementing significant reform is costly, then whatever benefits of the actual reform would be accrued have to be weighed against that costliness. So lots of free market types often tend to emphasize the deterrent benefits of our criminal justice system, as well as emphasize how the sort of racial disparities of crime as their cause. But I think what that really ignores is the fact that it presumes a degree of knowledge about the forms of alternative institutions that would be available. And so to some extent, I think that this is a misunderstanding of Coase. In Coase's original Lighthouse article, he says that the real benefit of case study approaches, like he's trying to do with the Lighthouse research program, is that they give us a vision of how diverse our institutional arrangements can be. If you want to understand how it is that firms can find a way to profit off of providing unconventional services, it would be a good practice to actually look at firms that offer relatively unconventional product offerings in certain markets and ask, well, how is it that they innovate, and how is it that they bundle services together, and how is it that they get non-payers to pay and exclude non-payers from use? And that's basically what Coase's whole program was about. I like to refer to it as sort of a just do it approach. He actually went to radio broadcast networks and started asking, okay, well, how is it that you guys, in light of this new technology of governing contractual usage of what at those times were not conventionally scarce resources such as radio waves? So to a large extent, if you're asking, well, how is it that we can build a Hayekian or Austrian perspective on crime and punishment, a more universal rationale of crime and punishment in the sense that our current overly narrow focused approaches and statistical investigations fall short. So for example, Levitt is looking at crime in the 1990s as it declined in major cities. That's not necessarily seeking after or updating our broader understanding of the concept or prominence of violence per se. So if we were to reintroduce a more universal theoretical approach, I would argue that what you need is both a longer historical perspective to sort of break outside of our more modern and postmodern recent histories and look further at the history and development of criminal justice more generally, not just necessarily the 19th and 20th centuries in the United States, for example, but rather the British legal system before that, as well as legal traditions dating back to basically the dawn of civilization. And secondly, I would argue that a broader variety of social environments is very useful. In other words, to look at not necessarily developed traditional state-based environments, but I actually think that anarchist research projects are particularly relevant to aiding in this search for a universal rationale of crime and punishment. If we look at radically alternative social environments, case studies where no traditional form of government like what we have in society today exists, and then ask critically, well, how is it that those agents manage to enforce contracts or manage to maintain trust so that they can trade and gain reputation and so on and so forth? It might tell us something about the various functional components of our current system, as well as sort of the intentions that we try to get out of our current system. So to give a bit of a background as to what we're up against, so to speak, from the sociological perspective, or what I really think the heavy lifting is being done by having these broader longer historical perspectives and broader case study approaches. So here we have a slide with both Naomi Klein and Bernard Harcourt. Now, Harcourt is arguably the extension of, say, Foucault in current sociological discourse about crime and punishment. Now, Foucault has this methodology of social space. He's delineating a space in our society and saying, okay, well, what's really going on in this space? And so he compares sort of prison environments relative to, say, classroom or factory environments. And what I think that this whole approach does is it conveniently parallels Austrian and public choice insights insofar as it is not based on physiological explanations. So in much the same way as Austrians, since the marginalist revolution, insist upon social explanations for social phenomena, the sociological perspective fleshed out by Foucault on this topic of crime and punishment does something similarly insofar as they investigate knowledge and incentives as they operate in social space. So that sounds really complicated with lots of buzzwords from the sociology profession. So that's in large part why I have Naomi Klein on this slide, because her presentation in her first book, No Logo, is more or less a digested version of this argument. So Naomi Klein, for example, is concerned about the way in which our social space is governed in society. She writes a book, it's called No Logo, and her biggest fear is that people really enjoy spending time in Starbucks and Barnes & Noble. Now, which seems odd because I would think most normal people have something much more fearful to be concerned about. But Klein's reason for this concern is because her starting point is actually the opposite, the complete sort of 180 of the classical liberal approach. The classical liberal approach, I would argue, has two fundamental components. One is the functional capacities and potentials of spontaneous order, ordinary human beings acting and interacting with one another to produce wealth and extend the division of labor. On the other hand, is its insight that the greatest threat to those spontaneous orders is the state. And so the classical liberal perspective is focused on constraining the role of the state and maximizing the potential of markets. Klein, on the other hand, her starting point is democratic social space rather than functioning society driven by spontaneous order. So when she sees people sitting in Starbucks who feel, look, and act as though they're free, we can sit in Starbucks, we can surf the net, we can read a book, we can stare at the wall for hours on end, we can have a conversation with a friend, we can meet up, we can even do business. You can arrange your appointments in a Starbucks and sort of meet clients and make money. And you don't necessarily have to give Starbucks a cut. They sort of encourage the use of the space by their customers. Now, Klein is concerned because of two reasons. Well, one, by being exposed to this form of social space, people are constantly subjected to the interests and marketing intentions of the owners or corporate agents that actually control that space. So, yeah, it appears that they want you to be free and enjoy yourself, but all they really want is to sell you something. Okay, well, that's true. I still don't necessarily see it as concerning. The second part of Klein's major concern is the opportunity cost of spending time in this form of social space. So in other words, this is where we recognize her starting point as being diametrically opposed to the classical liberal project, which is to say that her starting point is democratically provided social space. In other words, every hour that we spend in Starbucks and we're complacent with the quality of the latte and the quality of the music and the quality of the art that's on the walls and the comfort of the seats and so on and so forth is hours and attention that we're not necessarily spending in our quote-unquote democratically provided social space. So we don't go to the library, we don't go to the public park, we don't go to our PTA meetings as much. So Klein is very much concerned that the quality of our democratically provided social space will atrophy as our complacency with our privately provided social space increases. And lastly, she's very much concerned about the tolerance with which privately provided social space will have for civic engagement. In other words, yes, you can do lots of things in Starbucks or Barnes & Noble, but you probably can't have a labor union meeting which is aimed at boycotting Starbucks or Barnes & Noble. You probably couldn't coordinate a labor union strike amongst Starbucks employees at Starbucks without being sort of asked to leave or explicitly and forcefully removed. So what does this have to do with crime and punishment necessarily? Well, in particular, it's this last part, this without being forcefully removed. So Klein is concerned that the application of the force that we use to enforce property rights in privately provided social space suppresses democratic activism relative to doing those sorts of behaviors in democratically provided social space. So when the PTA or the labor union wants to meet at the public library or reserve a room at a public school, they're free to do so, and that works very well, whereas subjected to sort of private security officers and the rules and regulations of Starbucks or whatever when they try to do it in the privately provided social space. Harcourt does a very similar exercise in line with Foucault in trying to talk about the disciplinary characteristics of both violence on the one hand and markets on the other. So in Harcourt's latest book, the beginning part is a description of both our current, say, stock exchange and stock exchanges as they existed in the early part of the 19th century, mainly the world that Adam Smith and the classical economists lived in. So what Harcourt notices and points out is that to characterize the stock exchanges of old as being unregulated and laissez-faire is sort of a mischaracterization, or at least a very loose use of words like regulation, because there were rules. There were You had to have a license to enter the stock exchange. You had to submit your goods and services to certain regimented criteria. You had to abide by certain exchange ratios for certain types of grain and commodity stocks relative to precious metals and currencies. You had to comply with certain safety standards and regulations that were imposed by the stock exchange committee. I mean, it was more like a general open market, and then you had to sort of comply with all of these rules. And the ways in which non-compliance or disregard of those regulations would be enforced was oftentimes by means of physical force or violence. So the police, so to speak, who governed and regulated the market, by means of the market, were empowered. If you breached a contract, it's circa 1800 market space, you could use force by means of privately enlisted police or your own sort of physical prowess in order to impose the terms of the contract. Today we have comparable degrees of regulation, but the administration of force and enforcement is monopolized by the state. So Harcourt's concern, violence is disciplinary, that seems like it makes sense. The Foucault sort of parallels that get drawn is everything from militarization and regimentation. It's obvious to recognize this sort of unnatural process of forced regimentation in something that's explicitly disciplinary as, say, military training, right? People subject their otherwise natural preconditions to far more regimented routine of marching in ordered sort of structure. Foucault draws parallels from that to law enforcement and whippings and lashings circa the 1600s. And now Harcourt is trying to argue, well, the market process has a insofar as it's about incentives, sticks and carrots has a comparable disciplinary role in society. And insofar as markets are disciplinary and violence is disciplinary and they share this sort of creepy characteristic, he's concerned that the extended effort to enforce contracts in a growing and anonymous exchange society has led to our forms of mass incarceration. And so this correlation is taken from an article by Ezra Klein that we've talked about this throughout the course of this class, that this should be something that Austrians and free market types who want to talk about these issues should take very seriously, because it's a back of the envelope sort of correlation, and it doesn't seem to be incredibly powerful, but it does seem that like the major countries that we want to point to as saying, oh, look, they're economically free and prosperous and have good markets, also have this very unsavory characteristic of mass incarceration. And basically what I want to argue is that in contrast to this being a causal relationship, that we have to have this expanded role of mass incarceration in the presence of anonymous international markets, which is explicitly what the state of sociology is saying, I want to argue that the classical liberal perspective is a lot preferable insofar as we recognize that the state is predominantly parasitic, and that the reason why we see this correlation is because that form of parasite is going to be stronger the stronger that the host is. And so rather than saying that the market is being driven by expanded forms of incarceration and law enforcement and applied violence, it's instead being upheld by that. Now, again, how you get about recognizing this is by means of a longer historical perspective, right? Rather than using the 1800s as our starting point of understanding legal history in the criminal versus civil sense, it's sort of a midpoint, and we have to look back earlier to understand, well, what were the institutional conditions which led to a particular legal system before the rise of, say, the Industrial Revolution, how and what instigated changes amidst the Industrial Revolution, and then what our legal system looks like now. Also, I still think that the major challenge in all of these frameworks is to, and Harcourt and Hayek both sort of share this, is that we don't know how to appropriately characterize our society as either being laissez-faire or highly regulated. And Hayek talks about this in Counter-Revolution of Science. He says, yeah, you know, the corruption of methodology in the social sciences has led to an inability to diagnose social problems in an objective sense, right? And we see this in our current state of debate with regard to the financial crisis, right? People are saying, oh, well, we've been in this era of deregulation. And then on the other side, advocates of the market want to argue, well, no, we haven't been in an era of deregulation. We've been in an era of excessive regulation. So how you explicitly diagnose our social reality and social problems characterized within sort of becomes challenging if we don't have an objective science of or a basis of comparison. When understanding price theory, Mises had the evenly rotating economy, right? So whenever you wanted to understand, well, how is the production and distribution of goods and services operating, you could always look back to the presumptions and basic incentive structures that are at play in the evenly rotating economy. With criminal justice services or optimal punishment ratios in particular, it's almost impossible to do that without making some very explicit normative claims, and which ends up making you step outside the role of positive social scientists. So what I'm arguing is that by looking at longer historical processes, first off, and secondly, looking at a variety of case environments that include statelessness or anarchic systems or quasi-anarchic systems, that we can better construct what would otherwise be a form of evenly rotating economy, but not with regard to prices or capital structure, but with regard to punishment magnitudes. In other words, we're seeking what is the equilibrium price ratio of punishments for crimes in the absence of state manipulation over that pricing system. Now, admittedly, that's like almost difficult or impossible to do because we don't have wide-scale long-term social experiments in the anarchist experience. So instead, later in this presentation, what we'll do is go over sort of a framework or a collection of quasi-stateless environments that can hopefully serve to isolate various features and components of what people intend to do with the criminal justice system. The second thing is that one of the first things that comes to mind when you look at quasi-stateless environments is that most of them don't have prison systems. So it's sort of awkward to say, well, how does a prison system work in a stateless environment compared to one with a traditional state? Well, first and foremost, the stateless environments that we have good information about don't use prisons. So you have to take what I would call a structural functionalist approach. You have to say, okay, it's not so much that we have to find a formal criminal justice system from soup to nuts with police, courts, and prisons, and then compare and contrast them. Instead, what we should be asking is, what are the intentions and purposes and functions that are aimed at by means of the various components of our criminal justice system? And are those same functions and purposes being aimed at and acted towards in these stateless environments or quasi-stateless environments? And if so, how are they being accomplished, at what cost, and to what extent? And that's the sense in which we can compare the two systems. And so lots of things like proportionality or constraint or avoiding of rent-seeking capture and corruption or just low financial cost and low social cost and deterrence and incapacitation and rehabilitation, all of these forms of intentions are in fact accomplished in not necessarily perfectly, but by a variety of different institutional baskets and different functional forms in these stateless environments. So let's move on. Okay, so in contrast to the Naomi Klein sort of hardcore perspective, what I want to argue is in favor of a Tocquevillian perspective. So again, we're sort of ignoring the Becker approach of rationally calculative criminal justice and criminal agents. In Individualism and True and False, Hayek explicitly makes this distinction. He's like, okay, rationalistic individualism a la Jeremy Bentham inevitably leads to a forms of socialism. In other words, it's not so much that the pure economics of the Beckerian model is incorrect. It's probably very correct, but when it's applied incorrectly to all forms of behavior in every context, oftentimes it'll lose the tractable accuracy that the model is hoping for. And so what Tocqueville represents in this alternative perspective of classical liberalism, or individualism, so to speak, is a more evolutionary and discovery-oriented form of efficiency. That we don't necessarily derive models in our head and then plant them on society, but rather than individuals innovate and discover models of social relationships that they use to govern their own local settings, and that's the degree to which they work well and best, rather than say coming up with a formalistic model and imposing it in all times and places. And so again, Tocqueville recognized that there's a primacy of the spontaneous order, and that democratic processes, especially with regard to like special interest groups, capture and rent seeking, it lends towards a system of mob rule. So only insofar as our constitutions and our forms of governance have constrained those processes of democracy have we gotten the good results that we like over the course of history, things like economic growth, increased liberty, decentralized government, etc. So again, the form of some of these slides are funny. The research question in general is like, how does power operate within social space? And by power, we're specifically concerned with the application of coercive force as a law enforcement strategy. How is it that people enforce contracts then and today, so to speak? So again, to go back, I think that there are three very interesting patterns, or three historical examples with interesting patterns that we should be recognizing. The first is, well, in historical order, would be ancient Greece and my work on the Athenian system of criminal law and how it changes from a privately operational system to a publicly dysfunctional system. And what instigates that change is the prison system. Now, I want to argue, not many other people have argued this, that a similar role of the prison system should be recognized as motivating the changes that take place in the British system around the turn of the Industrial Revolution. In other words, what Harcourt's pointing out is, hey, look, you know, markets used to be very sort of violently enforced back in the day, and now he's arguing that they're still violently enforced because of the correlation that we observe between prisons and Western liberalism, so to speak. But I think that sort of misses the point of what's driving this change and how we should characteristically think of that change. So we see that we see a similar narrative take place in ancient Greece. We see a similar narrative take place in Britain around the time of the Industrial Revolution. And arguably, I would say we're seeing the same process unfold in the American experience surrounding mass incarceration today. Now, how it is that the social historians and social space scholars want to characterize this is that expanded markets lead to mass incarceration. And I want to say no, that instead this process is more driven by forms of bureaucratic incentives promoting state expansion in the particular realm of the criminal justice system. So while some arenas of our society become relatively liberalized or deregulated, or governments are avoided from them. So, for example, in the last 50 years, we've had tremendous trade liberalization when it comes to international policy. We largely to the efforts of scholars and free market advocates like Milton Friedman. It's a lot easier to get coffee grown from Colombia for me than it was for my parents when they were my age, which is just one generation ago. When we watch sort of Mad Men and these sort of historical piece television shows, it seems so quaint that they're surprised when beer comes all the way from Germany. Well, we don't think that's quaint anymore. We think it's standard and obvious that you should be able to get goods and services from all over the place. So I can see why many people would say, oh, well, like, our last few decades have been this deregulation rhetoric. But when you look in another sphere of the law or public policy, say the criminal justice system, that system has become far more state-dominated and far more hierarchically organized, let's say, or excessively regulated. Okay, so how this pattern, or what the narrative of this form of policy change looks like in the Greek case, this passage should give you a sense of how it is that the criminal justice system, for one, operated in ancient Greece before they had a state-sponsored criminal justice system. In other words, before there was a state, there was no criminal law, but instead the process operated as a civil legal process. Individuals pressed claims against one another, and that process had built into it a number of effective constraints and a number of effective incentives that led to a degree of efficiency. And what I mean by efficiency in that sense is that sentencing, or in other words, the rulings of how it was that criminal violators were treated would be proportioned, right? Socially recognized as being fair, as well as accomplished a degree of deterrence. People didn't necessarily want to incur large amounts of crime in their society. And it had a way in which once you were deemed criminal and to owe a debt, you could work it off, and the incentives were so that you could finish your sentence quickly. So this is a quote from Achilles Shield, which is the largest or most pervasively cited passage from the Iliad used to construct or reconstruct a vision of the legal system in ancient Greece by most classical historians. So in the assembly place where people gathered, their dispute had arisen. Two men were disputing about the recompense for a dead man. And I think that that's a key part about this phrase, is that someone here is dead. This isn't necessarily just a sheer civil violation where you would expect all of the concerns of each party to be ameliorated just by means of repayment, but this is actual, like, violence is involved, someone's dead, they're not necessarily coming back. All of the emotion and concern about violent crime would also be invoked in this example. And so how is it that the society in the ancient Greek world is going to be dealing with this? Well, the one was claiming to have paid it in full, making his statement to the people, but the other was refusing to receive anything. Both wished to obtain trial at the hands of the judge. So not only does this make reference to the fact that there was a sort of violent aggression that took place, but there was also a commonly recognized system of restitution that was in place. And only were they going to arbitrage or third party resolve after the breach of that repayment. And so the system is not necessarily a guarantee, but is instead like a starting point for secondary processes that take hold. So the people were cheering them both on. This is also very important because it demonstrates the sort of role of the general public and the jury system on the rulings of the magistrates or the judges, so to speak. Judges don't just make stuff up. They design sentences with a hope that it will appeal not only to the people who are involved in the trial, but all onlookers and the general sort of consumer market. The people were cheering them both on, supporting both sides, and heralds quieted the people. The elders sat on polished stones in a sacred circle and held in their hands scepters from the loud-voiced heralds. With these, they were then hurrying forward and giving their judgments in turn. So multiple judges had the opportunity to try to resolve the system and or the dispute, and the vested interests in the dispute could pick and select amongst them, as well as rule out by means of the shouting and observing crowd. In the middle lay 2 talents of gold to give to the one who delivered judgment most rightly amongst them. So this is literally a for-profit system of adjudication and conflict resolution that's being described in the earliest days of Greece, which is predominantly stateless insofar as it's a network of isolated city-states. No single monopoly enforcer of criminal justice, no single monopoly enforcer of law and order, etc. So fast forward a couple hundred years, and you get a very radically different description from another extremely popular source in ancient Greek history, Socrates' trial and Plato's Apology. And so Socrates here is complaining about the arbitrary nature of the sentencing process that he's being subjected to. He's bearing reference to the previous restitution-based system that used to work and drive a functional aspect of society that possessed a degree of rationality. And he's saying, look, you know, I'm going to end up going to jail and serving time to magistrates who weren't even affected by my crime. Why shouldn't I just be made to pay the person who supposedly I violated? So he's making reference to crimes that bear no victim. He's making reference to sentences that bear no reference to those crimes or those victims. And he's recognizing a sort of private interest that's vested in the system at the hands of the state as opposed to the interests of society. So a radically different system in the way in which crimes are being resolved and what's considered crime, how it's responded to, and how it's tried and punished can be demonstrated by looking at these two sources. So the question becomes, well, what motivates that change in the ancient Greek system? And I think, again, if we were to look at this through like the social space hypothesis that many people are looking at our current system through, we would imply something about, well, you know, Socrates lives in a more capitalist world or something, and these forms of institutions are needed in order to have that degree of development or needed in order to have that degree of social progress. It's almost a Whig version of history, I suppose, but I don't think it's an accurate one. Instead, what lots of historians have recognized is that the key legislative transition that takes place in ancient Greece centers around a reigning archon, Solon. And in particular, his reforms are so distinctive and unique because they're framed as penal reforms. So in the earliest days of Greece, when you had this restitution-based system in play, the letter of the law or the social norm might be in place so that things like death penalties or things like physical bodily harm were inflicted. But what that actually ended up doing was instigating a degree of bargaining between plaintiffs and defendants. So that when you violated someone's property rights, let's say, accidentally versus on purpose, you could refine the claimancy, the amount that you were owed, in order to increase for means of deterrence or decrease, and judges sort of recognize that. Insofar as you didn't make the repayment, individuals were liable to bring about the enforcement of that payment on their own. So there began a system of indentured servitude. Well, I take that back. They relied upon the already existing system of indentured servitude, which had a functional role to play in terms of lending markets. So when Solon came into power and he recognized that lots of people were being held in indentured servitude, he recognized that this was an opportunity to sort of like gain certain political traction. And so what he does is he revokes this privilege on the part of Athenian citizens to enforce the case rulings. If you were liable to me for, say, 500 drachma because of a case ruling, well, let's say you didn't have 500 drachma, well, then you could service that debt by means of an indentured servitude contract to me. Solon says that no longer will that be tolerated, because the only people who should be subjected to bodily force are slaves. And so by being subjected to individual enforcement or civil enforcement amongst citizens, he's saying that people lose their citizenship and become de facto slaves. So the state monopolizes this role. Individuals cannot use violent enforcement to promote their own contracts. Only the state can do that. So they prohibit private arrest and private incarceration. Well, then it revokes the sort of meat or the teeth of doing contracts. So the state has to then subsidize a form of enforcement. And so they build the first sort of prison and start doing this. Now, the prison system at this point in time has no sentencing to go along with it, because the sentencing system is still restitution driven. Well, prisons are used then as a secondary mechanism. You're only going to go to prison if you can't pay off your debt. And so right away, the prison sort of swells with lots of poor people who then can't pay off their debt. And so more like the net amount of estimated indentured servitude relative to the net amount of incarcerated Athenians after the development of the prison, the second is arguably larger, or predictably larger. In addition, they're all poor relative to the general population. So this instigates a form of civic activism. People like are seeing it in a way that they didn't see before and concerned about it. And so then Solon revokes the entire restitution-based system of criminal sentencing in favor of a time-based system of restitution. The delineation between a criminal law and a civil law is the first time this gets distinguished. Crimes are those things which violate the state's rights, whereas civil law are conflicts amongst individual people. And eventually, the state is sort of like a monopoly purveyor of all forms of criminal justice, whether it be courts, prisons, sentencing, etc., or the changing of legislation. Now, after the invention of the prison and then the subsequent changes that it invokes in the criminal justice system in ancient Greece, certain forms of state expansion and state regulation and state prohibition and state control become cheaper, become easier. It becomes easier to impose forced conscription, to levy new taxes. Solon ends up redistributing land ownership across the citizens, as well as controlling the money supply and the system of weights and measures. Arguably, many of these different unintended consequences that can be traced to the change in the legal system, but as instigated by the development of incarceration, led directly to the eventual collapse of the Athenian Empire, especially with regard to its ability to enlist in wars and fail to finance those endeavors optimally. So again, I think that this narrative arguably parallels the narrative that scholars like Harcourt are pointing out in the British system. So when we think about, well, the British system used to be this very similarly civil enforced process. So I'm thinking here in terms of research about the Lex Mercatorum done by Bruce Benson, right? We didn't used to have this distinction between criminal law is totally monopolized by the state. Criminal law is when you violate a crime against the society, and so when you're tried, it's the people versus you. Instead, we didn't have that. We used to just have basically civil processes, where in much the same way as if someone violates your property rights on accident and owes you a debt, if they violated them on purpose, then it was just a matter of sort of ratcheting up the payment a little bit in order to serve a deterrent role and a safety for the general population, in addition to the repayment to the victim. So the Lex Mercatorum and other systems like it, David Friedman's work in Iceland, as well as Benson talks about this happening throughout the Anglo-Saxon experience, that there were Virgeld systems, blood prices, different sort of bodily harms and physical harms and murderous deaths associated with different people in family structure and classes were related to different financial prices, as had to be paid back according to this, to the norm of restitution in those systems. Now, again, we recognize that that's not the way things work today, or even as late or as early as, say, the mid-19th century in England. And I would argue that this, in much the same way as this story is motivated and centered around the innovation of the prison experience in ancient Greece, arguably that timeline matches out well in the Anglo-Saxon European experience. So right around the 1800s, when Harcourt and Foucault are pointing out this sort of paradox of social spaces, wow, this market seems very violent compared to our current markets, but we're just sort of hiding that violence in a different realm. The market space at circa 1800 is in fact sort of delineating violence in order to enforce contracts, but also what's going on is that the state is monopolizing that power slowly but surely, again, by means of inventing and applying the prison system. So you have scholars like de Tocqueville traveling to the United States with the explicit intention to investigate our prison system, and report back to France and say, oh, well, the United States is doing this, and it's their belief is that it's driving a large part of the success and American exceptionalism that's taking place in the 1800s. Every major nation is also sending people, much like de Tocqueville, to either the United States or Britain in order to look at the new panopticon designs, the new isolated features of penitentiary systems. Tocqueville is like the only guy who says, no, it's really not that which drives the American exceptionalist experience, and he writes Democracy in America to argue that it's more about artful association, learning by doing, so on and so forth. So again, I would argue that there seems to be this suspicious correlation between the timing and development of the prison system and this schism between the criminal and the civil law, which arguably funnels massive amounts of more power into the state sphere than what we were used to. And arguably, what's really going on in those civil processes is a form of constraint that doesn't get replicated when you have the state be the sole authority on the criminal law. And now I would argue that this same process is basically what's getting instigated in our current system. By means of expanding exponentially the amount of incarceration under the control of the state, you're then changing the interests of how we use those resources to promote either state interests distinctively from social interests. So you see a massive amount of the ratio of expenditures in corrections as opposed to judicial or police. Some are deterring or avoiding of crime ex ante, whereas corrections is more about dealing with crime ex post. Clearly, ex ante deterrence and security is preferable to ex post from citizens' perspectives. As well, you see the massive sort of expansion relative to other countries. This, I think, is the most sort of revealing trend, which is that we end up using the bulk of our law enforcement resources more for prohibitions and regulations than we do for property rights violations. And again, it's systematically disproportionate. So what I guess in response to, say, Naomi Klein's sort of back of the envelope description of like the Starbucks space that can't be used for everything that we want to use it for, and that it threatens our democratically provided social space, I would recommend Googling three types of videos. One is I would recommend you going into YouTube and typing in like flash mob shopping mall or dancing in a shopping mall. So basically, this is like the pure expression of what the types of freedoms and liberties that Klein is talking about. People show up in a shopping mall, and then they coordinate all like dozens of people together, and they dance and have a wonderful time. There's one where like they do MC Hammer dance in a Gap. It's hilarious. Well, on the one hand, we can imagine a store manager that's like, wow, you guys are really getting in the way of my paying customers. I wish you wouldn't do this anymore. Please don't. If you do again, I'm going to have to call security. Or even anything as hostile or explicit as calling a security guard and having people like forcefully expelled from the storefront. Yes, that could definitely happen. Well, the second set of YouTube videos that I would invite you to check out would be specifically Target. People have tried to boycott and launch political demonstrations about Target's corporate policies, specifically regarding like women, time off, use of, I think, sweatshop labor, et cetera, for some of their capital stock. And people show up and they sort of dance and sing politically charged lyrics against Target Corporation. Now, obviously, Target doesn't like this. Like, we could argue maybe that people at the Gap where the people are doing the MC Hammer dance think it's funny, it's going to, like, bring goodwill, so on and so forth. In this example, it's far more obvious that, like, Target's very unhappy about it. But again, there's a degree of civil constraint in how forceful they're likely to be when they ask their protesters to leave or get their protesters to leave. Target certainly doesn't want like blood splattered all over their linoleum floor, let alone the bad publicity or civil liability associated with administering excessive violence within their public space. And then the last video that I'd recommend everyone watch is the recent sort of brouhaha that took place at the Jefferson Memorial. Here we have a social space provided by the state, and here we have enforcement, law enforcement provided by the state, and it is far more physically invasive and violent than is any of the forms of physical violence that we're used to being administered in the enforcement of regulations surrounding private space. So I think that highlights a key distinction that's going missing in a lot of the social space literature, mainly that when civil agents deploy violence, they are constrained by forms of civil liability and incentives that coexist within them. When governmental agencies deploy violence, they don't have that form of civil constraint, other than the political process, which in a variety of circumstances, if again, it's not constrained by a recognition of and a functional set of institutions, in particular constitutional institutions, that are cognizant of the hazards associated with democratic processes that people like Tocqueville pointed out. You're not going to get those forms of constraint, and it's a lot harder of a process to accomplish compared to that civil liability process, which is predominantly driven by spontaneous orders. Benson and others sort of point that out. So in the margin, I think that those three parallel histories that broaden our historical perspective really allude to that. Now, we've only got a little bit of time, and so admittedly the rest of the slides might feel a bit rushed, and for that I apologize. There's just so much material to go over in this sort of lecture. I just want to give you the overview, though, and the general framework. Austrian economics in particular has this history and association with transition economies. Now, transition economies, what we recognize is that the task of political institutions and craftsmanship is very, very different from, say, a tabula rasa Hobbesian experiment. Hobbes says, oh, in the state of nature, we need a government, and so on and so forth. That's different from saying, okay, well, here was a government, and now it's collapsed. How do we rebuild it? Rebuilding is probably a different to-do list as far as institutional development is concerned compared to development economics, or just building from state of zero. So with that same recognition that not all of these cases are identical, we don't always exist in like a blank slate, I present these various forms of quasi-statelessness to argue that there's going to be a different set of institutional constraints in each one. And the first one is non-states. And so where is it in human social history? Do you have environments where there's obviously no state, and it's just because no state has happened to come about? And so animal communities, for example, have
comparable processes of conflict and resolution strategies that service many of the intentional goals of our criminal justice system, things like deterrence, retribution, restitution, rehabilitation, reintegration, incapacitation, all of those things occur and operate within ape social environments. Now, totally tribal communities in the Neanderthal Paleolithic era have similar patterns, but the difference is between these social institutions of, say, ape species and the earliest of mankind is largely driven by intelligence differences. And so what we recognize is that animals are often not innovators when it comes to physical technologies, but animals were pretty effective innovators and discoverers on social institutions. In other words, everything from kissing to hugging to sort of smiling are these innovative ways in which the first sort of Homo sapien and ape type species learn to cope with violence and ameliorate those things. And now, primitive tribes don't necessarily have to be ancient civilizations, because we coexist in today's world with primitive tribes, and to some extent we should recognize not necessarily that their institutions are great in terms of economic development, because obviously they live in very rudimentary and subsistence conditions, but they are really telling insofar as they've stood the test of time and continuously proved to be robust amongst, in a lot of times, very, very hostile geographies. The sort of best work that's being done on this is by a guy, James Scott, on the art of not being governed. On ape social hierarchies and stuff like that, I would recommend reading Van der Waal, Peacemaking Amongst Primates, and then also The Company of Strangers by Paul Seabright. So another distinctive case or environment which isn't quasi-stateless insofar as it's distinct from our current scenario would be post-states, environments where states collapse for a variety of reasons. So you have environments like the Soviet Union and its collapse in this upper left photograph. You've got things like Haiti in the upper right, sort of driven by environmental crisis. And then you've got sort of Somalia in the bottom left, and the Middle East conflict and chaotic environments there. Now, again, the challenges of, say, criminal justice they don't go away just because your state went away. These people still have conflict. They still have property rights that need to be enforced. They still have resolution strategies that need to be deployed. But they're serviced by a very non-conventional package of services compared to our very formal criminal justice system today. And again, much like apes are these sort of like discovering agents experimenting with trial and error to find resolutions, we see similar sort of variants of these social contexts to comport with the degree to which they have good information, they have ability to engage in repeated play, like all of the conventional wisdoms that come out of, say, the literature on prisoners' dilemmas in the laboratory reveal themselves in the stateless environments that we observe here. Interstates, again, you get a lot of very interesting social processes that take place when states are in conditions of statelessness relative to one another, or groups are in conditions of statelessness relative to one another. So I would argue that everything from the Legis Mercatorum to the arms race to cyber hacking to feuds, Hatfields and McCoys and the Italian vendettas, for example, should be recognized as quasi-stateless environments, and we should be looking at the ways in which they resolve conflict in those high-stakes environments to recognize how we could restructure criminal justice institutions today. Anti-state environments are more explicitly hostile to state rule to ruling state authority for a variety of reasons. Some being that they intend to trade in illicit substances, so that would be sort of like underground economies and gangs. Others are because they seek sort of religious freedom, so the colonialist experience and the Puritans. Others because they explicitly flee genocide from those forms of state, so nomadic civilizations, etc. And then lastly, people who just have a proclivity to sort of rape, pillage, and plunder, mainly pirates. if anyone's familiar with the work of Pete Leeson or Diego Gambetta, these are very popular among sort of case study historians and economic historians today, in large part because the stakes are so high, specifically because you can't rely upon the state to enforce contracts. You can't rely upon the traditional criminal justice system in order to dole out punishments. So these people and groups have to be innovative on those margins, and again, they sort of discover mechanisms that suit their contextual constraints best. Now, what I would argue is super state environments is social order within the prison experience. In other words, a lot of our modeling sounds like, oh, well, if you're not going to have any degree of social order unless you have this exogenous provider of social order. Well, what happens when you're already like sort of caught up in the enforcement mechanism that's supposedly exogenous? Like, what, are you going to go to jail again when you're already in jail? So what we should expect to see amongst inmate social orders would be things like complete and total chaotic discord, but we don't see that. Instead, when we look at things like the POW camp experience, socialist gulags, concentration camps, the slave trades that took place, the colonial development of Australia, as well as like contemporary ethnographies being collected today, we see a lot of social order amongst inmates on their own stake, and we see a lot of disorder in those environments where the regime that's governing the prison is most totalitarian and heavy-handed. So things like Abu Ghraib, for example, as opposed. So this peace sign picture is from the Cebu prisoner inmates in the Philippines. They actually like sort of do these music videos and dance to Michael Jackson. It's a lot of fun. I recommend watching it on YouTube. So in other words, the variance of social outcomes that are observed in the prison experience comports to our general classical liberal sympathies that the government is best which governs least. And when you have a hands-off attitude to inmate control, inmates end up sort of finding ways in which they can resolve conflicts amongst themselves. When you get excessively heavy-handed with running the inmate facility, then you end up getting things like prison riots and social discord and like a total disregard for human rights, et cetera. I would argue that the experience of functional states also comports with the classical liberal perspective. The notion of economic freedom is the same point. Governments are best which govern least. And those environments where we've had some of the greatest success as far as economic development is concerned are those environments that most frequently hit the reset button on governance, those which experiment and discover new forms and ways to structure their institutions. And so lastly, what I recommend is that we think about the criminal versus civil legal distinction in the same way in which we've been recognizing the distinction between common and civil law origins in the colonial origins literature and development economics. In other words, I think that what the colonial origins literature argues is that common law systems effectively constrained the state, and that's why they were well suited for economic processes. So common law countries have good economic performance. Civil law countries had in their court systems, it was easy for local magistrates to sort of siphon wealth out of the tort system. Now, that's really interesting, and it tells us something about the difference between tort systems in common versus civil law countries. But what about the difference in criminal law systems between common and civil law countries? Well, again, going back to our original correlation, common law countries seem to have higher incarceration rates today. And I think in large part, this is because while we've accomplished constraint on the state in the tort process in common law countries, we haven't accomplished that form of constraint in the criminal law process, and instead we've embraced it as the appropriate role of the state. Now, in a civil law environment where the tort process is not as constrained, where the state is not as constrained within the tort process, it's going to siphon wealth therein. Why build a criminal justice bureaucracy when you can siphon wealth off of your tort system? The real money is in the corporations and the business owners and the contractual forms, not necessarily in shaking down thieves or building bureaucracy through additional cops on the street or prison facilities. So I think that framework is a much better explanatory one to understand why it is that places that have big markets and relatively free markets also have big prison populations and relatively large incarceral bureaucracies. So we're about at the hour mark. Let's field some questions before closing up. In regards to the mistaken notion that markets encourage violent enforcement in a system of incarceration, how do we account for private enforcement organizations such as the notorious Pinkerton Detective Agency during the 19th century? Organizations like the Pinkertons are typically portrayed as the evil capitalist machine cracking down on the little guy and generally being violent and agents of the state. Is this simply socialist mythology, or do they have a legitimate point? I'm less familiar with the Pinkertons specifically, but the role of private enforcement today, again, I think that the best response to this is something like these YouTube videos with different forms of spontaneous dancing. There are more private police in the United States, for example, than there are regular police, and that's true the world over. So my question is, there are almost no police brutality cases or serious sort of like violations of human rights by means of those private security agents relative to police brutality cases from the government. Now, then you get into sort of bias samples when you're looking at Pinkerton agencies circa the colonial experience or say Blackwater or quote-unquote private prisons today, and in large part because they're sort of like mixed bags. They're contracted out agencies. They're often in bed with the state. So it gets difficult to parse out the differences. But I would say, track the number of like lawsuits against private security agencies and the extent to which they've administered violence in ways beyond human rights or beyond proportionate representation, and then compare that to how many cases of police brutality take place. And I think that you would get a pretty clear image as to what the incentives are that constrain the application of violence in the private sector compared to the way in which governments lack that form of constraint when they have monopoly over the administration of violence. But Matt, I think that the Pinkertons are, the book of my familiarity with the Pinkerton experience comes out of watching Deadwood. So I would love to see more historical work be done on them, and I'd love to hear more about it if that's a topic that you're writing on. Anyone else have additional questions? Please use the chat box and not the Q&A panel, just because it's more to keep up with. Realize we only have 10 participants at today's lecture. Mises University is going on, so I talked to about 3 people who are in this class who are in attendance, so I assume that they are not attending this evening. Otherwise, we'd have a larger population as usual. Was ancient Rome's justice system similar to ancient Greece's? No, not really. Ancient Rome had a different system. They had the criminal versus civil legal system in place earlier in their development than Greece. So the later Greece system looked more like the Roman system. In fact, a lot of the inability to sort of diagnose and characterize Greece's legal system before Solon, for example, is driven by what's often called like false Roman presumptions, like the Western world is more informed or driven by Rome's legal system than, say, Greece's. And so a lot of historians have a difficult time sort of jettisoning that framework in order to look more positively at the Greek experience. So in other words, they had a delineation between civil and criminal law a bit before, more from the get-go. Which, to some extent, that means that, or I would say, Rome's experience is, again, probably a good parallel or a good thing to look at in relation to our current American experience. So again, this is another area of history that I think more people should be looking at explicitly. Like, how is it that the criminal justice system changes and adjusts in line with the collapse of the Roman Empire? In large part because of their early setup of a criminal versus civil distinction, the United States of America is the only nation in the course of human civilizational history that had that distinction from the get-go, but the only country that ever starts off right from the get-go with a public prosecutor's office, right, which is at heart the criminal justice system. Most national experiences all emerge from this, okay, civil law does everything, and then the state grows into a controller of the criminal law. That evolution or de-evolution, for more radical-minded folks, takes place in pretty much all legal histories. But because the United States experience was colonial, it was sort of after the fact. We started off with that legal at the tail end of that legal process, right from our get-go. And arguably, I think that helps explain a lot of why we go through this cycle faster and in conjunction with our unique democratic sort of characteristics, the fact that we're extremely heterogeneous, the fact that we've eroded many of the functional constraints upon the democratic processes in lockstep with the expansions of our criminal justice system. Do you know of any studies that have looked more broadly at the decline of civilizations or even just the decline of certain states with the rise of the state control of the criminal justice system, the expansion of your Athens paper to other states? No, I'd love to see it. I think it's fascinating. I think that perspective is probably right. Bob Higgs is sort of the closest to that. What I'd have in mind is something like Crisis and Leviathan, but centered around the arena of criminal justice as the spending avenue. Gulag by Anne Applebaum is also, like, I would imagine having that level of historical analysis in conjunction with the sort of Bob Higgs political economy would make for an amazing dissertation or an amazing book. It's how I think about motivating my research in the long haul. But if anybody were to write dissertations on that, I would love to be of guidance and whatnot. Could you elaborate on why you say that heavy-handedness in prison operation tends to lead to violence and social breakdown? Do you mean prisoner versus guard violence or prisoner versus prisoner? Well, in reality, it's sort of both, but more it's guard versus prisoner violence. So the comparison that I often put up is, on the one hand, we have experiences like Maine State Penitentiary in the late 1980s was in the state of Maine. The warden was strapped for cash and having a difficult time balancing the budget of the facility, and noticed that, well, inmates were really enjoying woodworking. And so he changed, it used to be that you could only accumulate a couple of $100 worth of tools and wood to work with, and then he lifted that constraint and said, okay, no, you can save as much stuff as you want to save. Relatively speaking, he took it from a couple $100 to about $10,000. So the inmates could, in fact, hold on to capital, accumulate capital, save capital, invest, and be more entrepreneurial and enterprising in that sense. Over a few month time period, many of the inmates started manufacturing goods and services, coordinating with one another into, like, very formalized firm structures that where they would sell these goods or services at local fairs, make significant profit, pay out labor wage rates to other inmates who they employed, impose policies about not violating each other's rights as contractual obligations with the firm that they were being employed with. And one of the inmates was even making like upwards of $80,000 a year and bought the prison cantina, right? The cafeteria, turn it into a profit-making enterprise. We've seen this happen in a variety of instances when wardens say, oh, well, I'm going to allow my inmates to sort of engage in social interaction with one another. The penitentiary, though, was designed in its inception with the opposite structure of social ordering in place. It was meant to completely isolate each individual person. Inmates were stored with bags over their heads so that they couldn't communicate with one another. Yet some degree of social order always sort of emerged nonetheless, because people would either tap on pipes to communicate to one another, save up their need to communicate only in the period of time that they were transported or whatever. And in those instances, the stakes get really higher, and the ability to discover and implement social norms is much more in tension. So the opposite case from, like, say, Maine State Penitentiary, a vibrant civil society, a vibrant commercial society emerges when the warden takes a hands-off approach. In contrast, you can look at something like the Zimbardo prison experiment, where within the course of 3 days, the psychologist having delineated people on either team inmate or team guard led to ordinary college kids basically like throwing feces at each other and setting things on fire within 3 days. So like the more out of sync the regulatory regime is with the general tastes and preferences of the community, the harder it is for that community to cope on its own terms, to tolerate one another in social interaction, but also the harder it is for the guards to sort of get effective control. So, I mean, to some extent, I mean both of the forms of violence that you're talking about. Sykes, Gresham Sykes, is a great example. He has a whole, he's one of the first people to talk about prison riots in these terms. He's like, the riot is when the formal regulations of the inmate facility are so out of whack with the informal preferences of the inmate community that the tensions are just unsustainable and cannot maintain. Would the behavior and incentives of private police be different if their relationship with public police didn't exist, as well as their constraints as private citizens? I'm not entirely sure what you mean, but I would say that the major difference between a private security officer and a public police officer, again, the heart of that distinction in today's world exists, is tied to incarceration. In other words, a private security officer might be able to detain you and might be able to apply certain forms of bodily force, like you can get a private bodyguard or something who would use force or who would carry a gun, but what they cannot do is arrest and incarcerate violators. The fact, not necessarily that they should be allowed to do that, but the fact that we delineate that ability to a monopolized state-based system creates a form of incentive in those agents that doesn't necessarily operate with private agents. And in fact, erodes the forms of constraint that those public agents would otherwise have if they were expected to exist in the private market. So would the behavior and incentives of private police be different if their relationship with public police didn't exist? Probably, because right now the private police, if they do need to make sort of like an arrest or if there is a criminal law involved, oftentimes you have to detain. Some states, this completely eliminates the potential for private prison facilities. New Jersey is an interesting example of this. Because of like a law that's on the books regarding if you were to have someone handcuffed and you had a gun, that's inappropriate. It doesn't matter who you are.
unless you're a police officer. So only agents of the state are allowed to sort of hold someone in bondage in the state of New Jersey. What does that mean? It means that if you're going to run a private prison company, it's almost impossible for you to transport inmates to and from your facility without enlisting traditional police officers. So just because of this sort of bottleneck legislation, that entire any cost saving strategies that could be deployed by contracting out private security in prisons in New Jersey isn't really eligible. So yeah, I think that the incentives would be different without some form of public police partnership. We've got about 10 minutes, so probably time for two more questions. I have one, but it will take a second to type. All right, Matt. Matt, I just saw your Facebook post. I'm sure they recorded it, and it'll be on the archive. So I definitely tried my best to answer the question about the Pinkertons. I hope you have access to it. But go ahead and send me an email after the class if you're still confused or if I didn't answer your question sufficiently. That's true for everyone in the course, by the way. If you have additional questions beyond what we cover in the course of the class, feel free to email me at danieljdemico@gmail.com. I'd be happy to respond individually or perhaps start the discussion off with our next class if the material is, I think, particularly relevant and needs to be shared with the class. Matt, are you still working on typing in your second question? Okay. Matt Tomko. With respect to your article on tattoo prohibition in prisons, very interesting article. Did you send it to anyone involved with the prison system? And if so, what was the feedback? It seems like such a simple and novel way for improvement. Well, thanks for reading that, Matt. I don't send things. There's sort of like a protocol with certain forms of sociological research, in particular what's called participatory ethnography, which is one in which you sort of engage more directly with your subject matter. I have volunteered or taken tours with a number of youth juvenile facilities and whatnot. But to be as heavy-handed as to expose your research findings to people who could otherwise be potential subjects of your research, it risks a degree of objectivity. So I have all my material available online. If other people were to sort of alert people enmeshed in the criminal justice system to that work, I'd be happy to get feedback. And every now and then I do. I just received an email from someone who had a lot of concern. He was about to be arrested or sort of tried for an outstanding conviction and sent a lot of comments about my interview with Jeff Tucker and some of the things that he had read on my website. Marik Kaminsky, when he does his work, he recommends that people who are sort of victimized or incarcerated research and investigate prison social history and the prison experience from a scholarly perspective as a coping mechanism for dealing with the conditions that they're in. I myself haven't researched that causal relationship more thoroughly, but it's just sort of a hobby of mine to sort of collect that type of feedback. The logic of state systems lends itself toward rational irrationality and exacerbates collective action and organization problems. How does the libertarian movement actually change the ways in which people act? If incentives matter, I don't think that education is enough to change the behavior of a population. Do you have any thoughts as to how the libertarian movement can seek to effectively change the current system of incarceration? That is an excellent question that I wish I had a far better answer for. I will say this, I think that toward a market-based approach, I think that more critical than, say, the libertarian movement, I think that libertarians or what we could say just the right has been, I think, really confused about the issue of incarceration in the criminal justice system. So there is not consensus. I would argue that there are what we would call like libertarian retributivists. My colleague Walter Block, for example, wants to advocate for certain forms of punishment being rationally deduced or applied to certain forms of criminal behaviors. I think that that approach is a large reason why we have the system that we have. So to some extent, the educational project has so much ground to win before we can think more critically about a more strategic one. As for a strategic one, I think that this is the latest book by this guy Peter Moskos on In Praise to Flogging. I think he fails at what he sets up for himself to do, which isn't surprising because what he sets himself up to do is to give a legitimate defense for corporal punishments by means of flogging. So he sets his heights a little bit too high and under-delivers on that. But what he's really trying to do is much more subtle, which is he just wants a sensationalist window in which we can view the real consequences and harsh reality that is our criminal justice system. And on that margin, I think he very much succeeds. The historical narrative that he tells is comparable to the one that I've been telling in the course of this class. And the sort of social costs that he explains, again, are very much in line with this class. What I think he is really doing effectively is taking a radical position and forcing a line of dialogue about these issues from a radical position is what I would think is the next step in making any significant strides towards social change. That we have to be willing to recognize that what is wrong in our system is a direct function of the institutional arrangements of the system itself. They are not a consequence necessarily of particular people's interests or particular policy tweaks that led to failures. They are systematic symptoms of a failure in the system itself. So you cannot hope to avoid mass incarceration in a heterogeneous democracy that is unconstrained as ours is. I think is the real sort of recognition. I also think that development issues are always great opportunities to learn a lot of practical skills of governance and policy suggestions. So, for example, I think that we lost out as Austrians very significantly in the last three decades for not contextualizing free banking arguments for the developing world. If we had had two or three case studies of applied free banking or, say, gold standard principles in the developing world, and then we had our financial crisis here in the United States, we'd be able to point to those cases and the success and like data that we get garnered in those experiences and then reflect back and ask more critically about how certain forms of institutions were succeeding in some environments where ours are explicitly failing today. Now, if we do similar things as far with law enforcement or legal processes, criminal legal processes in the developing world, I think that could also be very useful. You have mentioned books like In Praise of Flogging and several others over the course of the class. Can you and Danny possibly come up with a list of these books and post them in the forums? Matt, yes, of course, as well. If you email me any of the sort of questions, like if you're like, oh, well, you mentioned this other thing. So, yeah, I'll probably do a syllabus part two, additional recommended readings. Expect some of that stuff within the next 2 weeks or so. I've been traveling a lot lately, and I apologize for last week's canceled class if it messed up anyone's schedule. But the rest of the summer, I'm back home in New Orleans, and so I'll be working diligently and trying to get us all caught up with this class as well as a number of other projects. So I'll be happy to put that stuff up then. We're about at the 8:30 mark. And are you planning any future Mises Academy courses? Matt, all I can say is if you guys want it, I'm eager to provide. I'm more than willing and able. It's up to the Mises Institute to decide whether or not they want me to continue offering and what they want me to continue offering. I'd like to do this class again. I'd like to do other classes. So I think if students like yourself send an email and express an interest, I think that the Mises Institute is a consumer-driven organization. So just voice your preferences, and hopefully they'll be responded to. We're at the 8:30 mark. Thank you all for attending tonight, and I will definitely see you next week. Danny, I assume that you have all of the recording and whatnot.